overall review of the status of all the various numerical relativity groups, and a little shout out to USA Soccer here. That was the most exciting match I've ever watched, and I won't say anything more because I don't want to offend any Europeans or South Americans. So, just a brief outline. I'm going to very briskly and incompletely give a review of what goes into doing a numerical relativity simulation, and then I'll get into the current state of the art for various different classes of simulations. Various meaning two. Basically black hole binary simulations in vacuum, and then more recent progress with black hole binary simulations, including matter, which I'm initially electromagnetic fields, and then very recently actually including plasma in their simulations. And then also some recent developments in methodology. And then I'll just very briskly, like two slides, give a look at some data analysis implications and astronomy applications for the numerical relativity state of the art. And then I'll finish up with conclusions and questions. So just a very high level introduction to numerical relativity methodology. So there are very few analytic solutions in GR, and the n-body problem for n greater than 1, where the various n's are massive, is not, unfortunately, one of them. However, during the in-spiral, at least, you can use perturbative techniques like post-Newtonian, and they do quite well. However, once you get into the strong field regime, i.e. out of the perturbative regime, really the only thing you can do is solve the full nonlinear Einstein equations numerically on supercomputers. And so the energy momentum tensor over here on the right-hand side, that's non-trivial for the latter part where we're talking about matter. But in vacuum, it's actually set to zero. And so the equation is actually deceptively simple looking, but inside this simple statement is all black hole binary evolutions in vacuum, the gravitational waves they emit, et cetera. So as far as the approach that we take to solve these problems, we split the four-dimensional space-time into three spatial dimensions and one time dimension. I apologize to the 99% of you who are, more than up to date on this, but for the few people that aren't, just briskly go through this. You'll slice up that space, your space-time into t equals constant hypersurfaces with the three spatial dimensions. And so you'll have to specify all your data on some initial slice and boundary conditions, et cetera, and then evolve the initial value problem. And it's that easy, very straightforward, except there's some subtleties that caused this problem to be struggled with for, 30-some years. You need a decomposition of space-time that's well-posed and stable. You have a considerable amount of freedom in how you approach this problem. You can choose the variables you evolve, choose the gauge. Until recently, you were extracting radiation at a finite distance, often a fairly close distance, so you need to pick a good gauge because the waveforms aren't exactly gauge independent. The most popular choices currently are really modified BSSN. Or harmonic formulations, and there's different flavors within that I'll touch on when I address certain codes. And obviously, in black hole binary simulations, you need to be evolving a pair of singularities. Singularities are, generally speaking, difficult to numerically evolve stably. So there's a couple of approaches you can take. You can excise them, which means you apply a boundary condition around each black hole. You put that inside the horizon, and barring the existence of any superluminal modes in your evolution, that should be, that region should be causally disconnected anyway, and so it shouldn't affect your evolution. Another alternative is the so-called moving puncture paradigm, where you actually evolve the punctures, move them along the grid by a choice of gauge. That's been very robust and stable with finite difference codes. Another obvious difficulty that we encounter is the disparate length scales. In the near zone around the black holes, you'll need resolutions of, you know, m over 100, roughly. And in the, you want a wave zone that's, you know, anywhere from hundreds to more likely thousands of m. You need to resolve both those scales in three dimensions. And there's no surefire way to specify the correct initial data for the system that you really want to evolve. And an easy example is eccentricity. Possibly certainly the most interesting system is that with zero eccentricity for the cases where a system is circularized. Since gravitational radiation tends to circularize systems, you expect that most of them will be roughly circular. But it's turned out to be far from a trivial exercise to actually pick initial data that will give you a circular, quasi-circular evolution. So, in fact, it's not that easy to do this problem. Okay, so that's enough with the pedagogy. So now, going into the actual results, this is just a table sort of summarizing a few superlatives, the state of the art for a couple of statistics. And you'll note from the dates that, with a couple of exceptions, the superlatives actually haven't changed a ton since Ian Hinder gave this talk last year, with a couple exceptions. But the longest run that I'm aware of, at least, is still the equal mass non-spinning run by the Caltech Cornell, now CETA as well, collaboration. That was lasted 32 cycles or 16 orbits or 15 orbits and whatever you want to call the merger ring down, but 32 cycles of the waveform. And that also has the advantage of being the, as far as I know, again, the most accurate equal mass non-spinning simulation. Smallest mass ratio is still 10 to 1 published. Is still 10 to 1 for non-spinning case. That's Jose Gonzalez and Ulrich Baraka and Bernard Brueggemann. However, another recent result by Lusto combined a numerical relativity evolution of the punctures with a perturbative approach for calculating waveforms. And I believe they did a 10 to 1 in that paper. I've been told on some authority that Josef Zlokauer is going to address this point and possibly have some new things to tell us at 4:30 today. Largest recoil, what you consider largest depends on what kind of system you're interested in. It turns out that you can get gigantic recoils from hyperbolic encounters, as large as 10,000 kilometers per second. But for the quasi-circular systems, you can get recoils as large as 3,300 kilometers per second. Obviously, neither of these numbers are going to be typical. In fact, be incredibly rare. The general expectation will be much lower numbers when you take into account all orientations of the spins, et cetera. Highest initial spin in a simulation is, as far as I was able to dig up, 0.97 for the dimensional spin parameter on each hole for a head-on collision. Jeffrey Lovelace has a poster which I believe he's going to, he says some things about this. And I should also say that this uses a slightly different approach for initial data, conformally curved initial data. Superposes two Kerr shield holes, so it actually beats the bound, the maximum that we can get out of more standard, more typically used Bowen-York initial data choices, for those of you who know what those things mean. The highest final spin is 0.88 dimensionless spin parameter. For the individual spins aligned with the orbital angular momentum of the system. And I do note that, obviously, because you can set up larger initial spins using this system, you could potentially make them aligned and merge them and end up with a larger final spin black hole. So, and that may already be, you know, Jeffrey Lovelace may have that on his laptop right now, for all I know. But I haven't seen it in the paper yet, but, you know, that's certainly possible. And now a little bit more exotic, superlative, most energetic, meaning the most energy radiated as a fraction of rest mass, of ADM mass, I should say, of the system, is 14%. Absolutely, go ahead. Okay, but that hasn't appeared yet, right? Or it is in 2009. Okay, I see. Thank you. No, good. Okay, anyone whose results I'm misrepresenting, please just chime in and correct me, because this is certainly. Go ahead. It is. Okay. So it's hard to necessarily call it the actual maximum numbers out of the literature. So yes, like I said, please do. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I didn't remember that. Thank you. And people have done fits of how large of a final remnant you can end up with. I believe the maximum projected for initially maximal spins is something like 0.95 or something like this. So, you know, it sounds like Carlos and collaborators are pushing that limit. So, with those corrections, that's the brief summary of vacuum state-of-the-art results. Now I'll go into a little bit more detail with a few of them. The longest waveform, as I mentioned, it's equal mass non-spinning done by the Caltech-Cornell collaboration. Their code is you know, considerably different from a lot of the other codes in numerical relativity community, or really almost all of them. It uses spectral methods. It uses a first-order harmonic formulation of the 3 plus 1 split, and to date, it's yielding the smallest numerical errors. And just give a shout-out. Uli Sverhaka is giving a talk for an unequal mass long waveform later on today. And Mark Hanum is going to talk about how long you really need, presumably for LIGO purposes, for LIGO-Virgo purposes, and how long is just overkill. But really, my suspicion is you can't get too long for LISA. As far as the smallest mass ratio, as I mentioned, is 10 to 1. This simulation was calculated with a finite difference code, BAM, using a different formulation. And in addition to getting the largest smallest mass ratio to date, they also verified the kick formula, which you know, previously the smallest mass ratio was 6 to 1. You think 6 to 1, 10 to 1, not a huge difference, but actually when you have a kick formula that is most commonly used and is formulated as a fit in ADA, 10 to 1 actually gives you a data point at a considerably lower ADA from where everybody else was. So you see the previous suite of simulations by Gonzalez et al., and then where the 10 to 1 simulation fell. So it's a really nice verification of this kick formula. And again, see Joseph's talk. Excuse me. Largest recoil. So remember I split this up into generically largest and quasi-circular largest. Generically, you get the largest from hyperbolic encounters. You'll have a dependence in the relative orientation of the spin vectors and the orbital angular momentum vector. And it's a sinusoidal dependence of, it's actually this delta vector, the difference of the spins relative to the direction. Sorry, I misspoke. This is that delta vector relative to sort of the direction at plunge. So that notion to me is a little bit hard to define, but just suffice it to say, you can vary that delta orientation and calculate a recoil. So effectively, this theta might as well be your initial delta orientation, and you can go ahead and calculate recoils as you vary that, and you'll see the sinusoidal dependence. You see the same sinusoidal dependence, whether it be hyperbolic or quasi-circular. Just the numbers are different. You end up with a significantly smaller number. Oh, and I should mention these hyperbolic encounters. There's been some mention that it may happen for stellar black holes. You could have these, you know, extremely hyperbolic encounters, but and capture events. But this is never going to happen for supermassive black hole binary. I should never say never, but yeah, it's never going to happen. The large kicks over here for quasi-circular, which is more generic configuration, it's still, this is a very special configuration, the so-called, it has a name, it has the super kick configuration, where the two spins are pointing in the opposite direction, lying in the orbital plane. As soon as you move away from that, your recoils drop dramatically, so that the expectation value is considerably lower than this value. So if you do statistics, you're going to end up, even if you do random distribution of recoils, you get much lower numbers. If you put into play astrophysics, there's some results that suggest that the tendency is to push those spin vectors to align with the orbital angular momentum, so you get even lower numbers. So, but potentially, you can get huge things. Now, I separated this out. There's another exercise that has seen a lot of progress, which is, you know, we're cranking out these simulations, but there's got to be some way, just building up a stash of simulations isn't all that useful if you can't really condense that information and draw sort of general conclusions about it. And there's been considerable progress on this front. The so-called final state modeling has seen a lot of progress. For instance, results have shown you can predict the final spin magnitude and direction quite accurately given initial values at large separations. So that's certainly obviously quite useful for astrophysics. The kick can be well fit with input near merger or with initial numerical data. There's been a lot of work on this front, primarily recently by RIT group, as well as the Goddard group. There isn't a purely predictive formula yet, by which I mean a formula that for any configuration you like, you throw in the numbers and it spits out the recoil. The different parameters, to give you a sense, they have to be refit for different mass ratios. There's subtlety involved, but it is still extremely useful for statistics or for plugging into your astrophysical code for modeling whatever you like, structure formation, merger trees, et cetera. There's also been a lot of progress on interpreting the physics driving the kick near the merger. The recoil is totally dominated by the merger part of the recoil. But that's also the region where it's hardest to give a real concrete interpretation to what are the dynamics driving what you're observing. There's been progress on this front as far as studying momentum exchange, sort of using post-Newtonian as a source for intuition on these topics. There's also been progress on this anti-kick phenomenon that we see, which is if you actually go ahead and plot the velocity as a function of time, the final recoil isn't the same as the largest recoil. You actually can get going faster during merger, but then you'll have this effect where you slow down a little bit for some configurations. There's been a interpretation of this in terms of the curvature on the horizon of the black holes, and by Rizzola and all. So the physics driving these things is becoming clearer. And analytic models are sprouting up everywhere. So there's been tons and tons of progress on this for obvious reasons. There's a lot of motivation for LIGO applications and LISA applications, et cetera, for data analysis to have analytic models. So I list a few of them. This is no doubt an incomplete list. Talks on this topic are also ubiquitous. Here's a list of talks. Beanie Kelly has a poster where he's going to talk about some of these things. So a lot of effort in that direction. Finally, methods to try and measure the eccentricity in simulations, which is not as trivial a task as you would think in general relativity, and also methods to mitigate that eccentricity. As I was saying, specifying initial data that has no eccentricity is far from a trivial task. Those are areas being actively worked on, especially motivated by the NRAR collaboration. And I'll actually touch on this a little bit more later. Okay, so changing gears a little bit, the state of the art in including matter in these simulations. This area has from say 2006 to 2008 was sort of a gold rush of vacuum numerical results, so charging into new areas of parameter space, getting I remember, I think it was at an NRDA, in fact, that it was, a result coming out. Oh, maximum recoil is, 600. No, it's 1,500. No, it's 3,000, in span of days. It was just, can you top this type phenomena. So that slowed down. But matter, on the other hand, is speeding up considerably. Lots of groups are getting into this game. At present, there are three groups that have matter in their codes. That I'm aware of, that have published something that I'm aware of. There's two with electromagnetic fields. So as far as results in this area, this result isn't technically including matter, but it's a Goddard result, so I'm giving the talk. I can do what I want. This is Van Meter et al. Traced geodesics in black hole binary spacetime. And saw a Lorentz boost at merger, sort of in a Newtonian sense. You can think of this as an orbital slingshot. So close to merger, when things are getting very relativistic, black holes are moving fast, they can impart a lot of energy into particles. So you can potentially see a signature of that. These are geodesics, they're tracer particles, they're not massive, so you can't actually calculate anything, but it's suggestive. Then Bode et al. Incorporated hydrodynamics, so no electromagnetic fields, but gas, into black hole binary spacetime surrounding the binary, and calculated potential electromagnetic signatures from that. Then Palenzuela has had a series of results in this area, Palenzuela and collaborators, obviously, Luis being one of them. They evolved first the Einstein-Maxwell equations for just an electromagnetic field to see how lines, field lines, evolve through the merger and what potential signatures might come from that. I believe the general conclusion there is you don't expect necessarily a direct observable signature from the evolution of the electromagnetic fields through the merger, because that matches very closely with the gravitational radiation signature. And so it's at much, much too low a frequency for you to have any hope of seeing anything useful. But it can have other consequences that potentially are observable and are discussed in those papers. And then most recently, Palenzuela et al. Incorporated a plasma and showed a really interesting result where they see dual jets from a non-spinning black hole binary. So when you think of jets, probably the most popular mechanism for generating them is Blanford's Zanayak, which requires spin. So for a single non-spinning black hole, you won't see jets, but in the binary case, they're observed. So there's a number of potential interpretations of that. If people are interested, we can chat about that at the end. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Okay, thank you. I sent you guys an email. I didn't get any. Yeah. I'll go back and, yeah, I did. Shapiro was. Okay. That's all right. No, thank you for pointing that out. So, and here's some pretty pictures. This is the geodesic particles swirling around the black hole. This is the sort of tangled mess of electromagnetic field lines approaching merger. And this is really a particularly interesting result, the dual jets. This is a point during the late in spiral, just before the system merges, and you can see clearly the two jets coming out of each individual hole. So I'll talk a little bit more about that result, just because it's pretty interesting. So this is the full author list. They employ force-free assumption, which you can term that as the magnetic pressure being much greater than the gas pressure. Really, it's the plasma doesn't back react on the space-time. It just moves according to where the electromagnetic fields tell it to move. So the density of the gas is low. And as I mentioned, they find these dual jets. So I actually talked to Luis a little bit trying to understand this better. He was giving an explanation in terms of, well, the black holes are moving through space, so you can think of it as a membrane paradigm, you know, circuit being completed type phenomena. I was thinking of it as a, relating back to the geodesic picture, you can accelerate these particles as they swirl around a merging system. Some of them are going to escape, and given the magnetic field configuration of field lines going up, and the fact that it's a plasma and therefore can only move along field lines, you're going to have it going up and down. I'm not sure that it really matters. Maybe there are complementary interpretations, maybe. I don't know. But, you know. Anyway, so this is, there's lots of stuff to sort of dig into and better understand. So it's exciting results there. So moving on to methodology, sorry. Some recent advances. One of them is a multi-patch approach, the references up there. So by having this greater freedom in the geometry of the grid that you're using, you can calculate these systems much more efficiently, really dramatically more efficiently. In particular, a simple way to look at this, the waveforms are not going to gain any angular structure as they're propagating out. So there's no reason to have higher resolution in angular dimensions as you go further and further away. And yet for all the rectilinear grid systems, if you want to add space radially, you have to add it in the angular directions as well. One of the things the multipatch facilitates is just adding radial dimensions. So increasing the size of your grid is just an order n procedure for, you know, the number of radial elements that you add rather than n cubed. So that's a big advantage. Another big advance in methodology, Cauchy characteristic extraction. So this approach formally extracts the radiation at null infinity. In order to get a gauge invariant waveform, really that's the only place that you can extract and formally know that you have a gauge invariant waveform that you're extracting. However, one of the results of at least one of the papers on this topic shows that even though that's the case, the general practice of extracting at a finite radius and then extrapolating out to infinity works pretty well. So my eyes aren't that good to see that there's a blue curve. Maybe some of you can. I guess it looks a little like a mixture of blue and red, but the takeaway message being that these two curves are almost indistinguishable. I'm sure if you looked at a difference, it'd be more informative. But anyway, so that's a relief to know that all the results to date that haven't used this method are still usable. And as I previewed, reducing eccentricity is much less trivial task than you might think. Kepler's law won't help you. This is GR. So unfortunately, it's not that straightforward. A number of approaches have been developed. Historically, we would have these sequences of quasi-circular, conformally flat initial data that were calculated that we would plug in. So initially, there'd be no radial momentum on the punctures or the black holes, excised black holes, if you like. But unfortunately, that's not good enough out of the box to just take these initial data sets or take the procedure used to calculate them, plug it in to your code and evolve and get low eccentricity runs, especially when you're talking about putting spin in, things get more complicated. So this can be improved substantially by iterating on quasi-circular, so still keeping the quasi-circular assumption with r dot equal to zero, but iterating on your choice of the phi momentum until you suppress the eccentricity down significantly. One of the downsides of this is that then you have to evolve for some significant fraction of time, but if your code is extremely fast and efficient and accurate, et cetera, then that's not that big a deal. These publications show strictly non-spinning, suppressing eccentricity down to a part in 10 to the 5. Another alternative that's been developed is integrating the post-Newtonian equations of motion from some significantly larger separation, knowing that, so whatever momentum you give the black holes and whatever corresponding eccentricity they have will then radiate away, and at the end of the day, you can extract at the end of that post-Newtonian simulation both a phi and a radial momentum from that and plug it in, and it's been shown that that does a whole lot better. Although once you add spin, again, you do better when you add more PN terms, but for some configurations, like when you point the spins in the opposite direction, it doesn't do as well. So there's different, as I say in this next bullet, things just get messier with spins. So the recent NRAR effort, where people were, signing up, okay, I'm going to do this simulation, I'm going to do that simulation, it really became apparent that eccentricity was a major issue. So there's been a lot of effort very recently in focusing on mitigating this eccentricity for generic binaries, and it appears that it's succeeding. So Harold Pfeiffer sent me this plot, done by the CETA UMD group, a collaboration between several people at CETA and UMD. So you can see this is the number of iterations of this quasi-circular approach, but this time for a generic. So this theta is the polar orientation. I meant to catch Harold before I came up here, but I'm guessing it's the theta orientation of the total spin, something like that. Okay, right, this is a 1.5 to 1 mass ratio, and you're saying only one hole is spinning? Okay, all right. So, but still, you see, you know, over four iterations suppressing down to a part in 10 to the 4 eccentricity. So that's really encouraging. So because this is an RDA, figure, you know, should address some obvious data analysis questions, or at least questions I would have if I pretended to be a data analyst. So how much of the black hole binary parameter space has already been sampled? It's an obvious question. The answer is lots of it, but still, if you're talking about building a template bank, let's say, it's incredibly sparse, you know, not nearly enough for that purpose. However, you don't need nor want a template bank of numerical relativity simulations. Certainly not one for LISA. That would be, you know, vastly too many templates to calculate in order to have them closely, sufficiently close to one another that you wouldn't lose source, you know, do poorly in parameter estimation or whatever. Also, I expect for LIGO. It's totally impractical. But you do need, what you want is a model that you can throw any set of parameters you like at it, and it'll spit out the waveform. For this purpose, the bank of simulations is really useful, because then, when you do that, all you really need to do is develop this model and then touch base with the simulations that are available. And if there's a particular area of parameter space that you really want to focus in on and pin down better, then you do more simulations in that area. But you don't then need to blanket the entire parameter space with numerical relativity simulations. Okay. How many cycles are needed? How does that depend on the parameters? I don't know. Ask Mark Hannum. He's going to be giving a talk. He's going to be focusing on LIGO, I expect. And the question is going to be very detector dependent. So it's also a reason why it's difficult to answer that question. What accuracy is needed? Again, strongly, strongly dependent on the detector. And I wouldn't be the one to answer that. The data analyst should tell us what accuracy is required, and that'll, you know, at some point, hopefully drive the state of the art to where it's needed to go. How well do results from different codes compare? Well, there actually was a project assessing this. The answer for the cases they looked at was extremely well. Very large fitting factors with, you know, simulating the same physical scenario with different codes. So that's really encouraging. You would hope that would be the result. So it is. It's been demonstrated. So how close to merger can we trust post-Simtonian and the OB models? This is very dependent on the parameters, but the answer is, at least to me, was surprising that it was closer than you might think as far as how far back do you have to go? And again, it depends on the data analysis question you want to ask. One way to approach it is, you know, calculate internal estimates of the post-Newtonian error and numerical relativity error, and see how much of a loss in science you would get from having that much error in your waveform, et cetera. And as I say, it depends strongly on parameters. For instance, depending on whether, for large spinning cases in particular, depending on whether your spins are pointed in the same direction as the orbital angular momentum or the opposite, has a huge impact on your ISCO. So therefore, a huge impact on how close you are to ISCO with your post-Simtonian and your EOB at the start of the numerical run. So, and the closer you are to ISCO, general rule, the closer you are to ISCO, the worse you're going to do with post-Simtonian or EOB. How much will the black hole binary merger waveforms help in detecting gravitational waves and in measuring source parameters? Well, as far as detecting, hugely. In fact, you couldn't really have a hope of detecting, certainly with initial LIGO, there was no prayer. If you're doing a match filter, now there's you actually don't lose a whole lot of SNR by assuming no inherent intrinsic knowledge of the waveform, so you could still detect them. But if you're just talking about, you know, we don't have mergers to use, let's only use in-spirals and throw them at trying to detect things, then you'd have no hope until you had mergers in there, because they totally dominate the SNR. For LISA, they also totally dominate the SNR, although the in-spiral has obviously a significant SNR as well. So you'd still at least detect those systems. For parameter estimation, this question is more subtle. So especially for LISA, Because one of the big advantages of LISA as far as estimating parameters like sky position, which is of great interest for astronomy, is a lot of that information comes from the fact that LISA's orbiting. So you have an orbital modulation. It's tumbling and it's orbiting. So there's a lot of modulation going on there, but it's on an annual time scale. The merger happens, you know, very, very quickly, so you have none of that modulation in there. So the question was, how much intrinsic information is just contained in the merger itself, separate from orbit? It turns out, more than you might think, actually, just from naive assumptions about the increase in the SNR you get from merger, that actually is pretty indicative of the increase in accuracy that you get, which is somewhat surprising. So it doesn't seem to matter all that much, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute. And right now, actually. So one of the applications, there are lots and lots of astronomy applications. I'm just going to talk about this one because this is one of the few that I know something about. So one of the applications that is of interest and that where parameter estimation, in particular for LISA, really comes into the fore is using mergers to probe dark energy. So for ground-based detectors, you can actually localize, when you put mergers in for non-spinning cases, you can localize to less than the squared degree. And it's been shown previously you can detect systems out to a ratio of 1. So you're getting to, this is still pretty substantial, but there are, you know, large field of view electromagnetic surveys of that scale. So potentially you could have hopes of seeing counterpart signals, electromagnetic emission from the same source that's emitting the gravitational waves. So you could do really interesting science with that. LISA, on the other hand, can localize to of order 10 square arc minutes. Now, this is for non-spinning, actively working on what happens when you add spin in. In the in-spiral, if you add all relevant spin physics, or all known spin physics to date, you do a whole lot better than if you don't have spin. But it's not clear that this will bear out in the merger. In particular, we're breaking degeneracies by adding in the merger. Well, if you add the spin and you've already done better, do you then break more degeneracy, or did you already break the same degeneracies? You can't break the same degeneracy twice. So it remains to be seen how the merger will help you in those more generic cases. The incentive to calculate these things is really huge, because if you have a sufficiently small error box, you can hope to pin down the electromagnetic source. If you have a really tiny one, such that it contains, you know, one galaxy, then you don't even need an unambiguous electromagnetic counterpart signal. But you know, there's obviously a big incentive. You want a smoking gun. You want to see the really clear electromagnetic counterpart signal. So that's why adding matter is so critical. And it turns out that at least for sky localization, the information content in the merger is essentially orthogonal for LISA, orthogonal to what you got from the orbital modulation. So I'm showing here, this is uncertainty in latitude measured in arc minutes as a function of the time until coalescence. This blue curve is a paper that we did a while back where we just were looking at how well can you do with mergers and no orbital modulation. Previous results of post-Newtonian, back here, look at how well do you do with in-spiral with the orbit, but no merger. And then when you put the two together, which is the green curve here that I recently calculated, and see, well, how does adding the merger change things when you've already gotten down to this level from orbital modulation, you see that as soon as this blue curve drops below the level of these other guys, the green continues dipping down to that level. So they're really orthogonal pieces of information, which is, you know, really ideal. We couldn't have hoped for more. So it means when you add mergers in, you break different degeneracies. Or you get orthogonal information, not necessarily breaking degeneracies with other parameters. So in conclusion, progress in the vacuum problem continues. It's slowed down in its pace a bit, but it's still chugging along, pushing into more extreme regions of parameter space. A lot of progress has been made in trying to condense drawing general conclusions from the body of available waveforms that have already been calculated. a huge amount of progress really very recently has been made in incorporating matter and electromagnetic fields into these simulations. The methodological advances are continuing. You know, codes are getting more efficient, more accurate, you know, all the things that, you would hope. And this is obviously very relevant to data analysis, as we had a discussion earlier this morning about you know, how accurate do you need to get. And I would say that we're not nearly there yet, as well as we're doing. We're not nearly there yet for LISA, for even the simplest parameter choices you could make. And the simulations are being actively exploited by lots of groups to address data analysis, to make models, tune them to different regions of parameter space, numerical simulations, et cetera. And there's lots of critical questions in astronomy and cosmology, et cetera, that can be addressed that we've really only just started to scratch the surface. So there's going to be a lot more interesting results to come. So thank you.
Okay, so questions?
Yes, I think it was in slide number 6. Before.
This one?
Before? No. Later then.
Why don't you tell me?
It was the one that you listed the kicks, details of the kicks formulas.
I didn't actually go into the details of the kick formula.
Two comments there in the first set of bullets. You say the final spin, magnitude, and direction can be accurately predicted. So, I don't know if Barraus is going to speak about this in his presentation. Maybe he wants to comment on that. But the latest thing I read was that there were some issues with those formulas when you go into the a small mass ratio limit. So maybe there is new work on that.
Yeah, we can reproduce all available simulations, but there are not many simulations in the small mass ratio limit. And we can reproduce accurately all available simulations. It's not clear if transitional precession will be. We can. So all available NR simulations. It's not clear in cases in which the spin is anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. It's not clear whether transitional precession would be an issue. But in that, for those configurations, we don't have any NR simulations yet. So the question was whether we can reproduce actually small mass ratio NR simulations for small mass ratios as far as the final spin is concerned, and we can reproduce the Jena simulation for mass ratio 1/10. We can reproduce the final spin. The point is, in a region of parameter space where there are no simulations, and we only have post-Newtonian theory, that was shown in a paper by Emanuele. There are effects which are known as transitional precession effects, which may invalidate our result. But it's not clear in the strong field regime how how these effects will be important because there are no simulations.
I had one more comment on the third bullet about the kick physics there. We have heard from Abrahams that actually some people think now that, what do you mean by becoming clear? Because his argument was that...
That's purposely nebulous.
We only know we know nothing about what happens, what are the physics mechanism of these ups and down configurations for the spinning black holes. The analogies, the electromagnetic analogies, I think if I understood correctly, he argues the interpretation was incomplete. So, I don't know about the third bullet, if you want to update. Someone else want to say something? No, the origin of, or the, trying to dissect the mechanism that does the bobbing and then the final kick based on analogies. That's my interpretation of what I heard from the Abraham's talk.
Well, so if I understand right, I didn't think that it was at all clear that the actual recoil is just a continuation of the bobbing that gets truncated. In fact, it seems like it probably isn't, right? So.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think that what you said is very accurate, that the kick physics is becoming clearer. It's not clear, but certainly there are things that are known, and I think there's an increasing amount of work that is going to make that even more clear than it is right now. But there are still, of course, things left to learn about it.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? I had a question. On the LISA probing the dark energy, so that only probes dark energy if you get an electromagnetic counterpart, is that true?
Yes, because you need to have an independent a measure of redshift. So you don't get any redshift measurement from the gravitational radiation. That said, you don't necessarily need an unambiguous electromagnetic signature. Like, you don't need an igniting of an AGN, for example, if you can get your localization so precise that there's only one galaxy in your error box. And we're not nearly there yet. It's not clear that we'll ever be able to do that, but it's also not beyond the realm of possibility. You know, we're only a couple of order of magnitude shy. And it seems like every piece of physics you add, you gain an order of magnitude. That's a very, very rough rule of thumb. And we still have some physics to add. So.
Any other last questions? Okay, let's thank our speaker again.